Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Try me. You've got the power. Think. If you want me, I don't mind. Bewildered. $1 million seller, lost someone. The very latest release.
And now we continue our December series with Harvard historian Henry Louis Gates and his new book, Life Upon These Shores, Looking at African-American History, 1513 to 2008. And today we're really going to have some fun with the intersection of television history, political history, and music history. Cue Billy Eckstein.
Skylark, have you anything to say to me? Won't you tell me where my love can be?
Hello again, Dr. Gates.
I'm mesmerized. Let's not talk. Let's just listen.
Yeah, right. I'm for that. Except I like listening to you too. So we got a little James Brown action in there at the top. We're going to get back to James Brown,
but we're going to start with Billy Eckstein.
And we have put on our webpage the photo of Billy Eckstein from your book, handsome, debonair African American singer and trumpeter. In case you know. People don't know him, and some adoring white female fans in this photo. It's from Life magazine in 1950.
And in
your book, you call this photo revolutionary.
It was April 24th, 1950. And I first heard about this photo when I did a profile for the New Yorker of Harry Belafonte. And I said, what was the most important thing that happened in the civil rights era affecting you, your career, Harry, and black music and black entertainment? He said, oh, it's easy. Billy Eckstein photo. So I went to the Harvard Library, dug that photo out, and I decided when I did this book I was going to put that photograph in. And it was amazing, unprecedented, a very sexy Billy Eckstein surrounded by beautiful white girls who obviously are adoring him, shall we say. But the caption, Brian, says something like, Billy is looking at his fans in an avuncular way.
Oh, that is not an avuncular look in his eye, I'll tell you that.
No, in fact, Harry said when that photo hit, it was as if a barrier had been broken. And Billy Eckstein is not so widely remembered today, except old school people like me. But during the 40s and the 50s, Billy Eckstein's voice, as you say, played the trumpet. He also played the valve trombone and the guitar. It could be heard across the country. His version of Skylark, which you played, outsold Bing Crosby's version. And then he's remembered for songs like Prisoner of Love and A Cottage for Sale, which hit the top 10 in the 40s. Something else that's very important about Billy Eckstein, his was the first bop big band, the Billy Eckstein Orchestra, which ran between 44 and 47. And Sarah Vaughan sang with him, and many people came through his orchestra, like Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker, Miles Davis. They all talked about the effect that Billy Eckstein had on them.
Is there a meadow in the mist where someone's waiting to be kissed?
All right, Billy Eckstein.
And I'll tell you something else people don't know. He was descended from a legal interracial grandparents. His grandfather was Jewish, a Prussian grandfather, was born in 1863, married a black woman, and they legally married in the North, obviously, and they lived in Washington, D.C. And we don't tend to think of, you know, since Loving was only settled by the Supreme Court in 1967, making prohibitions on interracial marriage illegal, we don't think about, you know, those kind of relationships existing. But right. His grandparents were an interracial couple.
And from a marketing standpoint, if that's the right word, I noticed in that Life photo that he looked pretty light-skinned and was thinking, gosh, you know, would a darker-skinned African-American no matter how sexy, have been able to draw that same response from white female listeners.
It wouldn't have been in Life magazine, I tell you that. Now, remember, Nat King Cole would go on a few years later to be the first black performer to have his own TV program. It was successful. Everybody black in Piedmont, West Virginia, where I grew up, as you know, and therefore everybody black in the country watched it. But the sponsors were nervous. I think at one point he hugged a white singer, kissed her on the cheek, and that was the end of the Nat King Cole, Nat King Cole's TV program. But Billy Eckstine's important for one more historical reason. He became so popular that he took an extraordinary step, and he insisted that he would never perform at a Jim Crow venue, and he insisted that he be allowed to be a guest in whatever hotel that he was singing at.
And the thing is that he was so big that he had the clout to be able to do that and get away with it, and then that pushed the standard, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we've been tracing different motifs in these conversations, and one is baseball and the military and entertainment, and how these were all three different aspects of the popular front in the larger civil rights movement. You know, we all think about Brown v. Board and the Supreme Court decisions, but the front was broader than that. And entertainment certainly played a role, and Billy Eckstine should be remembered by all Americans for his pioneering role in civil rights and in entertainment.
Henry Louis Gates, his new book, Life Upon These Shores, looking at African-American history, 1513 to 2008. We flash forward to 1962, one of the most important live albums ever recorded. Okay, listeners, the BL blindfold test. Who knows this?
What you think of, but I know I know love. You're gonna miss me out of mind.
And that might be, you know, a little bit of a tough ID for some listeners, Professor Gates, only because that was not the hard funk you usually think of with James Brown. That was a little bit of a softer side.
Yeah, it was. That was the most amazing night. As far as I'm concerned, if I had to make, two great nights in the history of black entertainment, one would be the night that Michael Jackson at the Motown 25th introduced the moonwalk. And then everybody went crazy. One would be Lou Rawls Live in 1965. But the greatest would be October 24th, 1962. It was a Wednesday evening, and James Brown decided that he wanted to be the first R&B artist to release a live album. Brian, we take it for granted now, but that none had been done before. And he had joined, you know, James had a complicated life, a complicated childhood. At the age of 15, he's arrested for stealing a car, and then he's sentenced to the Georgia Juvenile Training Institute.
He served like 4 years, right?
Yeah, like 4 years. And he earned the nickname Music Box, and he formed a gospel group. So then when he comes out, he forms the Avons. And then he then changed that band, changed his name to the Flames. And Little Richard's manager, a guy named Clint Bradley, heard the Flames and produced their first single, Please, 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 which is on the Live at the Apollo album, which was released by King Records in Cincinnati, and that went to number 6 on Billboard. And then Try Me made number 1 in 1958, and then Think. But then so he was hot, but King Records refused to finance it. So James Brown set up this whole thing at the Apollo. The audience was packed, and he financed it himself. And that introduction you played at the top is by a guy named Fats Gonder. And from the second that Fats opened his mouth, you could just feel the electricity. And I think the people in the audience realized that history was being made, because their call and response all throughout that album is just electric. And he did another, by the way, he has two nods to Billy Eckstine with, he mentions Bewildered, which is a Billy Eckstine song. And, of course, James became famous for doing Prisoner of Love, Billy Eckstine's signature song. But he did, the innovation was to Lost Someone. He did Lost Someone for 10 minutes. And it's a prototype of rapping. And it would, do you remember Isaac Hayes's Hot Buttered Soul from 1969?
I do.
And he does Hot he does By the Time I Get to Phoenix for 9 minutes. And that is a direct riff on what James Brown introduced, excuse me, with Lost Someone lasting for 10 minutes. The album was released in January 1963, and it shot to number 2 on the charts, and Rolling Stone makes it number 24 in its list of 500 greatest albums. And in 2004, the Library of Congress enshrined it on its National Recording Registry. But I tell you where it's most enshrined: on my iPod, my iPad, and my everything. And when I'm at 30,000 feet, ostensibly being a scholar, I am at the Apollo Theater listening to James Brown. If I'm down, if I'm up, that album is just perfect.
Set to airplane mode and fly.
Try me. You've got the power. Think.
Now remember, this is just the intro to Brown.
If you want me, I don't mind.
All right, and that goes on, and that's that Fat Scander. And you know, you can almost hear a little bit of pre-rap in here, 15 years too early. Just because they had that kind of, you know, repeating funk thing, and then he can kind of talk riff over it. Again, even to introduce James Brown.
Yeah, and then if you look at, I have never done this or seen a study, but I bet if someone quantified the amount of sampling done in the history of hip-hop over the last 30 years, James Brown must be one or two in terms of the most sampled. Oh, by the way, nobody ever gives the Flames their credit, but the Flames were, they have three guys, Bobby Bird, Bobby Bennett, and Lloyd Stallworth, and they were a fundamental part of the magic that James created that night, and you know, and throughout his routine. And he went to one of the great nights of my life, Brian, September 18th. I'm a September baby, so September's my month. But September 18th, 2003, James Brown celebrated his 70th birthday back at the Apollo, doing those same songs. And everybody, as I say in the book, it was like the Talented 10th, Du Bois' Talented 10th, right, was there. And Ken Chenault was there, uh-huh. Richard Parsons was there, Henry McGee at HBO was there, Errol MacDonald, my editor of Random House, was there, and I was there. And you'd see all these guys getting up doing the boogaloo just like we were back in undergraduates in the late 60s and early 70s.
I hope some people from the 90% or the 99% were able to get in too. But let's flash forward to hip-hop, and obviously there's so much more about music and television and stuff in the book that we're not going to have time for in this short segment.
Are we going to miss Don Cornelius and Soul Train?
Let's see. I got to see if we have. We didn't get any clip of Don Cornelius, but you want to talk about Don Cornelius and Soul Train? That show ran for like 35 years.
Oh, yeah. No, that is the longest-running syndicated TV show in American history. And Don Cornelius was a little-known radio DJ in Chicago, and he got a job to become a sportscaster on, now get this, the name of the program was A Black's View of the News.
Oh, my.
And he thought that his TV would be, a better TV would be, I mean, his better future would be in TV rather than radio. That was a TV program. But by working at this TV station, he developed an idea for a black version of American Bandstand. And only one advertiser showed any interest, and surprisingly enough, it was Sears and Roebuck. And Sears and Roebuck had a long history of philanthropy toward African Americans, but they did it purely for profit because they wanted to increase record sales at their store. And it went live on August 17th, 1970, and it was a hit. And then Johnson Products, which is not to be confused with the great John Johnson of Ebony, but there was another two Johnson entrepreneurs, and Johnson Products Company was a beauty products company, and they produced Afro Sheen. We all used to put Afro Sheen on our afros. And they became the show's sponsor, and within a year, it had grown to 25 markets, and within 5 years, it was in 100 national markets, and it became the longest-running syndicated TV program in history, 1971 to 2006. And what's interesting about it is that it made black culture and black dance the, what can we call it, the lingua franca of American culture. Black music had always been a fundamental part. Back to minstrelsy, black music has always been a fundamental part of America's public identity. But with TV and this huge audience, American popular music became fundamentally black in a way that was impossible before. And that's all because of the genius of Don Cornelius.
And it happens over and over again, I think. White America starts to catch on to the blues, to jazz, to R&B, certainly to hip-hop. And we have 2 minutes left. You know, we're going to have to skip over all of hip-hop, which, of course, being contemporary, we talk about in a lot more than historical terms on this show, but you frame it as, with the exception of the Internet, arguably the most important cultural phenomenon in the world over the last 30 years. Can certainly make that case.
Yeah.
Skip over Roots.
Well, Roots is, by the way, don't skip over this. January 23rd, in a month, will be the 35th anniversary of the airing of Roots.
Which for 6 years was the most watched television show in U.S. history, with a 71% of American homes watching the same show if they had their television on. That could never happen today. But I want you to take our last minute to riff on the idea of the place of pop music in African-American history. All these forms, I mean, they've all transcended community into national music stature, but music plays a special role in oppressed communities, I think. The blues come naturally out of hard times. That's an obvious one. Is there any way in, you know, 45 seconds you can start to put into words, in general or for different times in African-American history, the relationship between the music and life?
Yeah, I think that the music was the only area that our ancestors could engage in beyond the reach of, well, not the only area, but the prime area, beyond the eyes of the master, beyond the eyes of people who were trying to oppress black people. They were in our literature, when we published books, our whole race was being judged on its collective intelligence. You know, were these people really human beings in the 18th century? Well, you know, were they worthy of not being slaves? But on Saturday night, man, it was just black on black.
And that has to be the last word. I think we have one more of these next week. And in the meantime, Henry Louis Gates, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays, my brother. And thanks for doing this series. It's been great.
Thank you for doing this series. Life Upon These Shores, looking at African-American history, 1513 to 2008, is the new book.